This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Title 18, United States Code, Section 1956, quoting now, laundering of monetary instruments. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 30th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The indictment unsealed today against former Trump campaign officials Paul Manafort and Rick Gates runs 31 pages. It alleges crimes of a financial nature, to wit, that the pair made millions of dollars lobbying for a pro-Russia political party in Ukraine and then, again allegedly, laundering that money through various offshore accounts and shell companies to hide its origins and avoid paying U.S. taxes. And then, again, allegedly spending it on luxury cars, $1 million worth of antique rugs, even college tuition and landscaping to the tune of more than $500,000 out in the Hamptons. So the Marketplace financial crime word of the day is money laundering. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains how it works.
29 Howard Street in Soho, New York, is a five-story green and ivory building surrounded by luxury boutiques. Iker Moreno, the creative director, works next door.
It's just a normal building like any other one.
Not according to today's indictment. It says in 2012, a company owned by Paul Manafort and his family, called MC Soho Holdings, bought a condo on the fourth floor for more than $2.8 million. The money came from offshore entities in Cyprus. John Byrne is president of the anti-money laundering firm Condor Consulting.
So it's taking those funds, putting them in something legitimate to disguise the source.
The indictment says Manafort then borrowed against the property, pretending it was a second home in order to get a larger loan. Meanwhile, he was renting the condo out for thousands of dollars a week on Airbnb.
All that money derives from the original illegal act of failure to file what their activities were with the federal government and failure to file accurate tax returns based on those funds.
Moyara Rusin is an associate professor at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. She says this kind of scheme is common. The Treasury Department now requires title insurers to identify the actual buyers of high-end real estate in cities like New York and Miami.
It will certainly make corrupt individuals think twice before purchasing property in those areas.
But she says there are plenty of other upscale markets where the order doesn't apply. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There is some dot connecting to be done to get from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's original brief, which was, remember, an investigation into the Russian government's efforts to interfere in our 2016 election, and today's indictments. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour is on that one.
Tax evasion, money laundering, failure to register as a foreign agent, charges dating as far back as 2006, but there's nothing in the indictment about colluding with Russia to tamper with democracy.
I think it's not at all surprising.
Lisa Kern Griffin is professor of law at Duke University. First, former campaign manager Paul Manafort has been under scrutiny since long before Mueller's investigation began. It makes sense. Those issues would come up first. Second,
there's nothing to suggest, moreover, that there won't be additional charges. This does not have the feel of an endgame at all. It is the very beginning.
prosecutors don't have to lay out everything they know in the first indictment. In some ways, it's not a coincidence that the first charges are tax and money related, says Mitchell Roth, professor of criminal justice and criminology at Sam Houston State University.
Anything to do with money, there's always some type of paper trail one way or another.
This makes tax records a fruitful place for prosecutors to look in a whole variety of situations.
It can be something as minor as the records of a drug dealer, you know, a crack house or something like that. It's just whenever there's some type of written records, the IRS comes into it or the tax authorities.
And these seemingly unrelated charges are useful to prosecutors. William Spade is an attorney in Philadelphia and a former assistant district attorney.
Prosecutors often will indict somebody based on unrelated charges if they think that that person has information about somebody up the chain.
How Paul Manafort responds to these indictments and whether he has more to say about anyone else may determine the next stage of the Russia investigation. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, how about something not Russia or Manafort or Trump related, huh? Open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act starts on Wednesday. Government numbers out today show that almost half of the population lives in places where they will be able to choose from just three potential insurers. In other words, not a whole lot of competition, so you'd expect, given supply, demand, and that whole thing, you'd expect premiums to be high. However, in places where there are 7 or 8 or even 12 insurers in the same market, premiums have still gone up considerably. Marketplace's Rima Kreis explains that this year, insurance companies aren't necessarily looking at each other when it comes to setting those premiums.
Nope. These days, they've got their eye on Washington, says Matt Fiedler of the Brookings Institution.
The reason we're seeing premiums go up so much this year is that insurers are anticipating that 2018 is going to be a fairly ugly year in the individual market.
He says this market is usually competitive on price, but an even bigger pricing mechanism has thrown things out of whack. President Donald Trump got rid of what's known as cost-sharing reduction payments. Those were given to insurance companies to help pay for out-of-pocket costs for low-income people. Now, premiums are expected to soar about 35% on average, says Larry Levitt of the Kaiser Family Foundation.
In some cases, states have actually told insurers how much to raise premiums to offset the loss of subsidy payments from the federal government.
So much for healthy competition. But that's just one of many forces that are pushing premiums up, according to Linda Blumberg of the Urban Institute. She says insurers are expecting enrollees on average to be sicker and fewer. That's because the Trump administration is cutting the enrollment period in half and getting rid of almost all advertising.
And this is something that the insurers have to take into account when they're setting premiums, because they're looking forward saying, what is the pool of people insured in 2018 going to look like?
Now, one would assume if premiums are going up, this is bad for people buying insurance. But
the math is incredibly counterintuitive.
That's Levitt. He says most enrollees are eligible for premium subsidies, which generally go up when premiums go up. So those people are not going to have to pay more. If anything, people in many cases are going to end up paying less. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Monday, more down than up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here with a truism about the looming debate on the tax bill. I say looming because there is, as of yet, no actual official bill to debate. But once it's out, that'll be on Wednesday, according to Republican leaders in the House, once it's out, things are going to get interesting because we are going to learn whose interests are on the line and at risk. Today we learned the National Association of Home Builders is a firm. No, they are a giant lobbying firm for the, obviously, home building industry. Jerry Howard is the CEO of the association, and when we spoke earlier today, I asked him why his group is now opposed.
Well, we look at tax legislation as having three components to it: personal taxation, business taxation, and the commitment to housing. The framework of the proposal that came out about a month ago certainly demonstrated that it would have all three. But as we've gotten closer to the introduction of the legislation, our understanding is that the commitment to housing, which is so important to us, will not be in the bill.
Do me a favor and break it down for the layperson in the audience, what exactly the issue is here with the tax credit and the mortgage interest deduction and the proposal that you thought was going to be in this bill.
Sure. The framework, when it came out, talked about leaving the mortgage interest deduction alone and not touching it. And as a practical matter, by doubling the standard deduction, you are reducing significantly the number of taxpayers that would take the mortgage interest deduction. Leaving the mortgage interest deduction only for the super wealthy. And we felt that a concept that we had been working on internally of a tax credit for all homeowners would go significantly, much more significantly, to the middle class. So we approached Chairman Brady with that concept. We spent the better part of 3 or 4 months working very closely with his team on that. We were under the impression that it would be put in the document, only to receive phone calls on Friday and Saturday saying that it wouldn't happen.
Seems like Speaker Ryan, perhaps, and Congressman Brady of House Ways and Means, they caught you a little bit flat-footed on this.
Congressman Brady and I talked on Friday night. He was as disappointed as we were that the tax credit would not be put in. The speaker told me that he has no policy problems with it, but that it's such a big new idea that he didn't think that we had time to explain it to the rank and file Republican members. I disagree with the speaker on that, and I'm very disappointed.
Interesting you say there's not enough time, because the GOP is certainly hustling to get this thing done.
Yeah, they say they want to get it done before Thanksgiving.
I wonder whether you've considered the secrecy with which the GOP seems to be writing this bill, and how that may, as the details come out, lose them support from organizations like yours and others who don't like what they see in this bill that they may not have known about.
I think that my experience in tax legislation and its broad experience leads me to conclude that when the details come out, there'll be a lot of people who are unhappy with the bill. That would be the case no matter which party was writing it or when it was being written. Tax legislation has significant winners or losers, and my job is just to make sure that the housing sector is not one of the losers.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go, sir. A lot of the pieces I've seen on this morning about your change in position says you will actively oppose this bill. What does that mean?
We're going to do everything we can. We have members of our association that live in every congressional district in the country. We're going to activate them and get them to meet with their members of Congress, urging them to vote against it. We're going to run ads in key congressional districts of members we know are undecided right now. We're going to do literally use every tactic we can to make sure that this bill in its current form does not pass.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Howard is the CEO of the National Association of Home Builders, now opposed to the tax bill making its way through Congress. Mr. Howard, thanks very much for your time, sir.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Kai.
Busy week this one is. We are going to find out this week probably who President Trump wants to chair the Federal Reserve for the next 4 years. An interview on that topic rather coming up in just a minute. Right now, though, your questions, our answers, another edition of our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder.
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blatant.
Elizabeth Mastin is a retired nurse in Norfolk, Virginia, with a question of interest to the Federal Reserve and central bankers everywhere.
I'm just curious as to how much money there is in the world. Does anybody keep records as to how much money the world has?
The short answer, Ms. Mastin, is yes. The longer answer is, here's Marketplace's Mitchell Harmon.
So how much money is there? Somebody knows.
A number called M0, which essentially is the number of notes and coins in circulation.
That's Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
For the United States, that number on the Federal Reserve website, somewhere in the vicinity of $1.5 trillion.
A comparable tally for the whole world, according to the Bank for International Settlements, including yen, euros, yuan, shekels, dinars, and all the rest, is about $5 trillion. So there you go. Question answered. Only it's not quite that simple, explains Jeff Desjardins at the financial media site Visual Capitalist.
That amount goes much, much higher. When you add in checking accounts or savings accounts or money market accounts, not quite physical money, but you can make a bank transaction digitally and use that as money.
This is called broad money. And according to the CIA fact book, there's more than 80 trillion of it worldwide, mostly in banks available to use or move around, to buy a pair of shoes, a share of stock, or a penthouse apartment on Fifth Avenue. Although it's worth noting, most of that isn't actually cash sitting in bank vaults, explains Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics. It's bank balances on digital ledgers, money people deposited and then banks lent out again.
Banks always have your money out working in the economy. If everybody lined up suddenly and went to the bank to get cash, you'd have a classic banking run.
Like in the classic Jimmy Stewart film, It's a Wonderful Life.
About an hour ago, I handled all our cash. All of it.
Every cent of it, and still was less than we owed.
Holy mackerel.
And then I got scared, George, and closed the doors.
Federal deposit insurance now guarantees the U.S. government will pony up our cash if a bank fails and can't give it back to us. Petru says the U.S. dollar is very popular the world over for central bank reserves, wealthy people's cash hoards, and criminal enterprises.
It's the most liquid currency because the stability of the United States as a global store of value and safety is one of the most important assets this country has.
And by the way, though we do know how much U.S. currency is in circulation, $1.5 trillion, beyond that, it gets a little murky. The U.S. Treasury estimates about two-thirds isn't even in the U.S. anymore. And because paper money's hard to trace, we don't actually know who's got a lot of it or what it's being used for. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Come on, you've got questions about business and economics. We are here to answer them. There's a place you can ask at marketplace.org. Coming up.
You've got to see several moves ahead rather than just one or two.
The tax code is complicated enough, y'all. Never mind trying to update it. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 85 points today, 0.3%, closed at 23,348. The NASDAQ off 2 points. We'll call that flat, 66.98. The S&P 500 down 8 points, 0.3%, 25.72. A move to merge mobile carriers Sprint and T-Mobile is facing some setbacks. The plan would turn the big four to the big three, with Verizon and AT&T leading the pack nonetheless. Sprint dialed down 9.2% today. T-Mobile hung up about 5.3%. Macy's is shopping around for good news with little in sight, despite the company closing stores and revamping some sections like makeup. The retailer fell again, down 4.3% today. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year Treasury notes fell to 2.37%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As promised, a brief detour now into some Federal Reserve Kremlinology. We have been told by the White House that a decision from the president on who he wants to chair the central bank should come on Thursday. Bearing in mind the appropriate caveats about nothing in this White House being done until it is actually done, we're going to talk to Victoria Guida from Politico about the incumbent, her record, and her possible successor, if it comes to that. It's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
You know how a lot of times when there's a change in administration, people start talking about being the new president's economy, whether it's Trump's economy or Bush's economy or Obama's economy. You know how that happens?
Yes.
Okay. So the real question for you is, how much of what's going on in this economy the last 4 years makes it Janet Yellen's economy?
That is a great question. I think that there's a considerable argument to be made that during her term, she was one of the biggest drivers of the economy, because one of the major choices that she made was not to raise interest rates until 2015. You know, she continued to keep stimulating the economy, even though employment had dropped below 5%. And I think that that was a decision that seems to have paid off, because unemployment continues to go down without inflation, without prices going up very much. So, I think that she had a really big impact on the economy.
I wonder then what your sense, based on your reporting, is why it looks like she might be out of a job.
I think that the two main things that were driving his choice to not reappoint her were, A, there's a lot of opposition to her among conservative Republicans, and B, he wants to have his own Fed. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to re-up somebody who was appointed by President Obama.
Given that this is Monday, and your reporting and others says the decision could come by Thursday before the president leaves on his trip to Asia, the front runner right now is a guy by the name of Jay Powell, currently on the Board of Governors. Give us the thumbnail sketch on him, would you?
Yeah, sure. So this is somebody who served under George H.W. Bush in the Treasury Department. His background is in investment banking and private equity. He was nominated to the Fed board in 2012 by President Obama. Since April, he has been in charge of regulatory policy at the Fed. He's mild-mannered, consensus-type guy. It's hard to find anybody who really strongly objects to him.
With the caveat that the stock market is not the economy, and the economy is not the stock market, obviously, I wonder how much the president is counting on a boost in the markets if he goes with, say, a Jay Powell, or conceivably reappointing Chair Yellen, which is not out of the realm of possibility, and traders saying, oh, good, another steady hand for four more years.
Right. Well, it's interesting because the president does seem to care about the stock market. He brings it up
bit.
A lot.
Yeah.
But I don't really know if that's really the long term factor into deciding who's going to be the Fed chair. I mean, probably markets learn to live with whoever is in there. So, you know, there'd been some talk of it being John Taylor, which I'm sure markets would have in the short term reacted negatively to. But once they got a feel for what he was going to do, I'm sure that effect would have been exaggerated. So, I mean, it's probably not the biggest factor in what he's looking at.
Victoria Guida, she covers banking regulation and the Fed for Politico. Victoria, thanks very much for your time.
Sure. Thank you.
We end somewhat as we began today, in the weeds of the Internal Revenue Code. While Paul Manafort and Rick Gates assemble their defenses against charges of, among other things, fraudulent tax practices, the people whose livelihoods depend on faithful interpretation of the tax code are paying especially close attention to what's going on in Congress right now. As I said earlier, the GOP tax plan is set to come out on Wednesday, and for accountants, changes to it are money in the bank, more business to them. What keeps them up at night, though, is the never-ending game of what's in the bill today but out tomorrow. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports that for accountants, this bill cannot get across the finish line fast enough.
Last year, when Hollywood released a big-budget thriller starring Ben Affleck as an accountant-turned-ruthless killer, Kim Dula was all over it.
I actually watched it twice. I watched it once with my husband.
The accountant. He has evaded every government agency.
And then she made her kids watch it.
And I said, see, your mom really isn't just a dorky CPA.
Dula loves danger and suspense on screen, but not in her accounting practice. The suspense and uncertainty around the tax plan are killing her clients. Dula says they're in a frenzy about the fate of their cherished deductions.
Is it going to expire? And is it going to come back? And are they going to make it retroactive?
Dula says keeping clients' blood pressure under control comes with the territory.
That's sort of our job, and that's what we're here for.
But the uncertainty is hard on accountants. They need that tax law signed, sealed, and delivered so they can get to the real work at hand, what they're paid for, discovering new loopholes to exploit. Brian Thompson is an accountant in Little Rock, Arkansas. He says, obviously, you start with the big stuff.
You always look for things that weren't there before that could benefit your clients as well as harm them.
Things like reconfigured tax brackets or lower taxes on income from business partnerships or changes to sections of the tax code on write-offs.
So certainly you're looking for those special items like, you know, increases in Section 179.
Like I said, the section of the tax code on write-offs. Once you've identified the new stuff coming in, then Thompson says you look for what's going to go away, like the deductions for state and local income taxes, and what fancy footwork you can use to make up for the loss. But not all accountants are created equal. So what separates the really successful loophole hunters from everybody else?
It's being able to play chess rather than checkers.
Michael Gratz teaches tax law at Columbia Law School.
You've got to see several moves ahead rather than just one or two.
Like identifying a novel way to create a loss that can offset taxable gains. Gratz says it helps to have an opponent who's not quite as skilled.
You often have world champion chess players playing against, if not amateurs, much lower paid and busier professionals.
Those would be the professionals at the IRS. But at the moment, there's not much for anyone to work with. The Republicans' tax outline is only 9 pages. The last time we had reform, the Reagan administration released nearly 500 pages of detailed proposals way in advance. Now, that was something accountants could obsess over. When Republicans introduce their actual tax bill later this week, Gratz says,
the accountants and lawyers will start poring over it to see where the gaps are, where the possible advantages are.
And when they find them, the hunt for loopholes will give way to a lobbying free-for-all to influence things before the bill becomes law. But it won't stop there. Back in 1986, not long after President Reagan signed tax reform legislation, lobbyists began going after what they couldn't change earlier, like tighter taxation of corporations' foreign earnings. Now, that's just a distant memory. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Amy alluded to it in her story about Manafort and his alleged money laundering. His use of that condo in Manhattan as an Airbnb property bought, again, allegedly, with unreported proceeds and rented out for thousands of dollars a month on Airbnb. It turns out, in addition to his substantial problems with the feds, Mr. Manafort might be in trouble with the city of New York. Turns out it's illegal to rent out an entire apartment in New York City for less than 30 days. Has been since 2010. Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. The Dow off 85 today, about 0.3%. The NASDAQ basically flat. S&P 500 down 8, about 0.3%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Haley Hirschman, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.